Folks, hello, hello. We're in House Business and Labor Committee has come to order, but I want you all to quiet down and shut your phones off.
Please,
because I'm a mannerly, courteous fellow. Yes. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3183. Teresa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3183 clarifies that an educational institution can provide non-elective employer contributions to a tax-sheltered annuity or a custodial account on behalf of the employee.
And we have Representative McPherson here today to explain to us what we're doing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Representative Greg McPherson from House District 38, Lake Oswego and parts of Southwest Portland. I know a lot of people at this stage in the session will say, I have a little bill. And I say, I have a little bill, and it really is a little bill. It doesn't really do anything besides clarify the law so that what things that are already happening can continue to happen. It relates to what are called Section 403B annuities or custodial accounts. There are two different versions of them. 403B is a reference to a section of the federal tax code that allows certain nonprofit organizations and public employers to establish savings vehicles for their employees under which the employees get tax-deferred savings like a 401k plan. But this is for public and nonprofit employees. And in their most typical form, they are an employee-funded device where the employee elects to reduce his or her pay by a certain amount, and then that is put into the account or the annuity vehicle, and then invested and tax-deferred during the period of investment until distribution at the time of retirement. So it's the, sort of the classic form of retirement savings on a tax-preferred basis. What our statutes do now is they very clearly and explicitly authorize that to be done by educational employers with respect to those salary reduction contributions, that is, savings by the employee at the employee's own expense because it's coming out of the employee's pay and being put into the account. What the statutes do not so clearly, in fact, not clearly at all, authorize is for the employer to put the employer's money into the account as well. And that's what this bill does, is it creates clear statutory authority for the employer to put money in along with the employee's money. Now, arguably, the authority is already there. In fact, this is already happening for a number of educational employers. But because there's this explicit provision of our statutes that authorize this to be done for employee money, it raises the question about whether the authority exists for the employers to do so as well. And this was brought to my attention by a benefits attorney who is near and dear to me, who happens to be my wife, and who suggested that since I'm in a position to clarify the law, that it would be helpful to her and to clients that she works with to have this point clarified. So all this bill does is to create that authority, and it is in Section 3 of the bill, starting on line 22 of page 1. There are some changes further up that are, looks to me like just matters of form and style that legislative counsel does whenever they get into a provision that's otherwise being amended. They'll update it to conform to their form style and style code or protocols. But the substance of this bill is to add clear authority for an educational institution to make employer contributions to a Section 403B annuity. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Representative. This is well written in your opinion and ready to go then?
I think it is fine.
All right. Any questions of Representative McPherson? Representative Berger.
Representative McPherson, why is the language around educational institution, is it only educational institutions, not all public employees who are eligible for this kind of a 401?
It's actually
for 403B.
403Bs are explicitly authorized for public educational institutions and for a range of nonprofits. And
okay,
so you see them primarily in the public sector. You see them for educators and not for other public employees. And that's
so
why it's
the tie into the 403B.
That's
Got
right.
It. I understand. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions of the representative? All right, sir. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing my bill.
My pleasure. Denise Yonker, please.
Hi. Chair Schossler, members of the committee. My name is Denise Yonker. I'm the Benefits Manager and Human Resources Director for the Oregon University System. And we do operate a 403B program. And I'm very happy to hear Representative McPherson's clarification of the bill that he's proposed. I do support the bill, and one of the reasons that I'm here today is that we have never interpreted this bill to allow us to make employer non-elective contributions, and so this is a welcome clarification. We do want to have that ability. It helps us with strategic benefit planning, and we support the bill as drafted so that we could use that in the future if we ever have an opportunity to redesign our plans. So this is a move forward to make our 403B plan that we've never thought could be anything other than an elective employee deferral actually look more on the par with other plans that our national peers operate. So I don't have any other comments besides this, but I do want to express support for the bill, and thank you for hearing my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions of Ms. Yonker? All right. Very good.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3183, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3183 and entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I move House Bill 3183 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger.
I'm looking for any subsequent referrals. Okay, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 3183 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Excused. Aye. Representative, would you like to carry this bill on the floor?
I'd be happy to, although it could also go on the consent calendar.
I'll entertain a motion to put it on the consent calendar. Any objection? Let's go ahead.
Yeah, put it on the consent calendar. I make that move if you want to.
Representative Holby moves that we put 3183 on the consent calendar. Are there any objections?
Well, I have no objection. I'm just worried that Representative McPherson's wife might think he's not giving enough weight to her bill. But that's okay.
I think I can solve that problem if we think the consent calendar is better. It really is not a change. Apparently there are some...
No, I don't object to the consent.
Okay.
It's his wife I'm worried
Very
about.
Very good. Without objection, then it will be put it on the
We'll let him explain that.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3183. I'm going to jump down to open a public hearing on House Bill 2140.
To my notes, Mr. Chair. That's okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2140 makes technical changes to the public contracting code. We first heard the bill on January 19th. You have in front of you a -1 amendment that makes further technical changes to the public contracting code.
Thank you very much. Just for everyone listening, I intend to do this bill and then work the last two, and then we'll jump up to the top and work through what we have remaining. Thank you. I'd like to call Diane Lancaster, Jessica Adamson, and Dana Anderson, please. Come up and explain what we're doing here. Whoever wants to go first, just go right to it.
Chair Schossler and Schossler, members of the committee, my name is Dana Anderson.
Thank you.
I'm the Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice, 1162 Court Street, Northeast in Salem. We're here to talk about that -1 amendment to House Bill 2140 Now, I want to clarify some testimony presented to the committee at the January 19 public hearing on House Bill 2140. The basic measure is the one that that makes technical amendments to the public contracting code that the Department of Administrative Services and Department of Justice work on every session to try to consolidate technical changes and refinements to make the code clearer and to make it work better. My testimony will be short unless you have some questions. The key points, I've outlined before what House Bill 2140 does. The key points, the -1 amendment, would be to refine descriptions on the application of the code and related code exemptions. This is sort of a technical matter that DOJ and DAS have worked out over many, many months of discussions and are now in agreement. And that same group worked on changes to the individual state agency procurement authorities. Who has limited procurement authority and what do they have it for versus what do they have to go to DAS for? It provides for more consistent use of defined terms. Another technical area such as state agency, state contracting agency, services, and personal services. We want to state them right. We want to state them consistently throughout the code. So DOJ recommends adoption of this, and I want to clarify a couple of points that were raised at the January hearing, and that is there were two matters that the Associated General Contractors were concerned about. The first where a matter is construction on the 279C side of the code, but it doesn't rise to the level of a public improvement. It's minor services, ordinary repair to take care of a public movement, improvement, and that kind of thing. What do you do then on the statute in 279C that flips you back to the process for procurement on the 279B side? And so what DOJ has done to address that is to put in a requirement for a competition that's reasonable under the circumstances, paralleling model public contract rules, so that there's some guidance to agencies and entities, including but not limited to, and lists the various kinds of methods for having a quick procurement, not just a direct deployment, which is what we're trying to avoid. The second one has to do with exemptions from competitive bidding requirements for public improvement contracts, again, on the 279C side. And there are two criteria there. One has to do with that it is unlikely to affect competition or to encourage favoritism. And the other one is that it will result in substantial cost savings to the public contracting agency. You recall last time our discussion was, that's a tough standard because it's like saying it will be 83 degrees on Sunday. We know it might be kind of warm. We're hoping it's going to be 83, but we can't guarantee it. So the AGC had some concerns about our approach in that terminology, using a standard that their legal subcommittee would be difficult to apply, which was reasonably expect to resolve substantial competition. So what we did in response to that is we took the flip side of the favoritism and competition things that said is unlikely to result in, and made it a positive statement, will likely result in substantial cost savings. And then we also incorporated what's kind of been dangling out there in the definitions of findings. It's eight additional criteria, really. but it doesn't say how it ties in. And so for the first time, this ties that definition into the code finding statute. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. We received a copy of the amendments this morning, and so have been going through this bill, trying to make sure that we fully understand what they do. For the most part, we think that these amendments address the concerns that we had and raised, particularly with respect to the emergency procurements. What we don't want to see in an emergency is a contracting agency that may have 2 or 3 days to award a contract, such as what happened in Highway 35 this last winter, just hand a contract over without using the appropriate measures to ensure they get the most competitive bid possible under the circumstances. So the additional language around those procurements provides us comfort that will indeed happen. We are more comfortable with the language dealing with standard for determining whether it will result in cost savings. We remain concerned with the language on page 22, starting on line 29, dealing with a pilot project to determine whether the use of an alternative contracting method will actually result in cost savings to the agency or not. What we don't want to see and what we may be concerned about is an agency that hears about a really nifty idea at a conference and decides to give it a whirl, not knowing what they're doing. I'm not suggesting in any way that larger agencies such as the Department of Transportation or DAS, that would not be their approach. They're very thoughtful and careful in how they apply these. We're more concerned about less sophisticated, smaller agencies that may take this approach, not knowing what it will do, and find themselves in a heap of trouble. Alternative contracting is a useful tool, but only a useful tool if applied appropriately. We have more stories than what we would like to have about agencies who have chosen to undertake one of those procurements and found themselves spending a lot more money than they needed to because they ended up with a mess on a project that could have been done under design, bid, build, but they went a different route. We have some hesitation with that, but I think that if this committee is intent on moving this bill today, we can continue to work on that issue elsewhere, or we're happy to continue the conversation. We believe we can come back in relatively short order with a resolution on that. With respect to the other contents of the amendment, we're comfortable with the remainder of those, and again, appreciate addressing those other issues that we had raised previously.
Ms. Lancaster.
Yes, Chair Schaffler, representative of the committee, Diane Lancaster from the State Procurement Office at Department of Administrative Services. We have been working hard for the last few months, as you requested. We're well satisfied with the Dash 1 amendments as they stand.
These, every year, every session, this has been before us, and every session it's a struggle. Be quite frank. And at every session, be honest with you, average legislators have to have a lot of faith in the people working on this. Now, I carried the initial one last session, and it was not complete. If there are reservations on anyone, and we do move this out today, I want those spelled out in detail, and I want to say them on the House floor. I have no problem. I don't know what the will of the committee here is. Personally, we are under a deadline, and whether this is the right thing to do or not, as far as the deadline goes, it's there, and it exists, and it's real. And I'm going to ask the committee here in a moment what their desires are. That if there's any reservations, I want to know what they are specifically and how they're going to be changed so I can spell it out very clearly on the floor to the people that will be voting for this now. And possibly we could have to bring it back here or send it on to rules. I don't know how that would happen. Any questions of these fine people? Representative Berger.
Yeah, Jessica, in my notes, I mean, we're going back to January. That was eons ago in my mind on this kind of a complicated bill. And I have, Jessica, policy changes, emergency contracts, and you said that you were satisfied with that resolution.
Correct.
And changing will to reasonably expected, and you eventually got will likely or will not likely. In other words, you're satisfied with that. I have nothing in my notes on this issue. Did you mention it in January before? Or did I just not put it in my notes, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I'm not sure whether or not I mentioned it on the record. I know that we had the conversation with the sponsors about that issue.
Okay.
Chair Schaffler and members of the committee, my notes likewise reflect AGC, Honda, and two other concerns they had that we addressed. The Department of Justice intends to work with groups such as AGC to make this pilot project thing work, and what, you know, there's a limitation to it. It has to be a type of procurement that particular agency has never used before, like design-build contracts. So they get one shot at exploring that form of alternative procurement, alternative to competitive bidding. And then they have to make some findings according to the way this is phrased, so that they establish whether it did actually result in cost savings. And then when they do a similar project in the future, they got to flip back to those findings. So in order to move this forward, we've pledged to work with AGC to get the rules to implement this, the model public contract rules, which local governments get by default if they don't adopt their own. So most agencies have those rules, so that we address the expectations of this. And then if there are problems, we can come back and examine it in the next session. Unfortunately, all kinds of requirements are pressed against the public contracting code, and new things arise, and, you know, we kind of had to have several cutoffs or we would have even more amendments for you. But fortunately, you have some deadlines here that kind of shuts the door on those. So I think, unfortunately, that will be an ongoing process.
And there's always next session, sir.
There's always next session.
And, you know, no matter, even if we thought we were perfect this session, this is going to come back every session.
Mm-hmm.
So I really, any further questions or comments?
Mr. Jessica? Chair, we would be comfortable with an approach that dealt with this issue in rule. I just felt strongly we need to put that on the record.
Thank you.
That is an issue that we don't want to see this section to be viewed by local agencies as an open invitation to use an alternative contracting method just for the sake of giving it a whirl.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a pretty big pamphlet to look at real quick. I'm curious if any of the amendments to 279 contained in this bill make any changes to Senate Bill 477, which we passed last session.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, none of these address that issue. Those issues are contained in House Bill 2021.
Okay.
And Representative, I can promise you if this had qualified rehabilitation facility issues, the packet would be this thick.
Are there any on that committee too?
All three of you feel comfortable moving ahead with this, all of you that are testifying today?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Committee members, do you feel comfortable working this out of here, and we can express the reservations that have been stated on the floor and just keep this process going?
Yes.
All right. Very good. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2140 and open work session on House Bill 2140. I'll entertain a motion. Mm-hmm. Representative Escobar.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that we adapt the -1 amendments as an appendage to House Bill 2140 and adopt.
Representative Escobar moves we adopt the -1. Yes. -1.
-1.
That's correct, yes.
To House Bill 2140. Is there any discussion?
Hand in group.
Is there any objection? So moved. Representative Escobar.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move 2140 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Escobar moves House Bill 2140 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Excuse. Aye. If you'd like to carry it, Representative, you're a fine American. All right, then I'm going to close work session on House Bill 2140. I'm going to open work session on House Bill 2758.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2, we first heard House Bill 2758 on April 11th, and we considered the Dash 3 amendment, which replaced the bill. During the hearing, there was discussion of a Dash 4 amendment, which is almost identical to the Dash 3. The Dash 4 amendment is in front of you. The only changes between the Dash 4 and the Dash 3 is that the Dash 4 changes some language in regards to the warranties on parts from between the RV dealer and the RV a manufacturer, and also removes the section in the Dash 3 amendment that dealt with recreational vehicle shows. And Sean Miller is available to answer any questions on the Dash
4. Actually, Mr. Miller, would you just come on up here and let us know the most recent events in this bill for us before we do something?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Recreational Vehicle Dealers Association. The first hearing, as Teresa said, there was three different issues in the bill. The first issue being the show provisions, which prohibited out-of-state dealers from participating in shows. You heard several different sides of that issue. We decided to remove that from the Dash 3. That was the only opposition to the Dash 3 amendment at the first hearing. That leaves two remaining issues, Mr. Chairman. One of them is the midnight move-in change to landlord-tenant law, which was introduced by the Lodging Association. Mr. Bill Perry is here to answer any questions. But that particular issue was approved by the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, which is landlords, tenants, legal aid. And so that issue has been vetted and approved and consensus. The second issue is dealing with a warranty reimbursement, just a technical change to the warranty reimbursement between RV dealers and RV manufacturers. And again, that's a negotiated change between myself and Mr. Brenneman, who's behind me, who represents the RV manufacturers and supported by both dealers and manufacturers. And so, Mr. Chairman, like I said, the three different issues, the one controversial issue you heard at the last hearing has been removed, which leaves, we believe, a product that is supported by all the participants. Thank you.
So you feel comfortable that all of those nice folks who are here airing their concerns are satisfied with these changes?
With that not in the bill?
Yes. All right. I don't see anybody out there jumping up and down with hair on fire. So, any questions of Mr. Miller before he goes? All right. Thank you, Sean. Okay. I'll entertain a motion, please. Representative Escobar.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 4 amendments to 2758.
Representative Escobar moves we adopt the Dash 4 amendments in House Bill 2758. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Very good. Representative.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move 2758 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative moves House Bill 2758 to the floor as amended. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Excuse. Aye. Would anyone like to carry this bill? Representative Edwards.
Carry it.
Very good. Thank you very much. Close work session on House Bill 2758. Open work session on House Bill 2021.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we first heard House Bill 2021 on January 19th. The original measure establishes that if a public agency fails to include state and federal prevailing wage rates in a public works contract or fails to include information showing which of the rates are higher for the workers, the agency is liable for the unpaid minimum wages, which includes fringe benefits, and an additional amount equal to unpaid wages as liquidated damages. You have in front of you a Dash 3 amendment, which replaces the bill. It modifies the sections of U.S. Code pertaining to the Davis-Bacon Act that are referenced throughout various statutes in ORS Chapter 279C, and it also clarifies the projects that are regulated under the Davis-Bacon Act are exempt from prevailing wage rate, except for the applicability of state and federal wages, so that if the state rate is higher than the federal rate, the contractor and every subcontractor shall pay at least the state prevailing wage rate.
Great. Representative Berger?
Yeah, I have in my notes here, is anybody in the chair, maybe staff knows, that there was concern over the penalty in the original bill. What was changed in the, is it the same?
No, actually, I believe it's been eliminated from the
bill. Okay, so.
Does anyone require any further explanation?
Is somebody going to come forward and talk about it, or is this it? the penalty was eliminated.
Ms. Adamson knows everything.
And I would like
we're
her to
blessed
tell
with
all.
Her presence.
I would like her to tell all. I am trying not to be obstructionist, Mr.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Associate General Contracts, awfully high standard to be held to. So, anyway, the Dash 3 amendment, one of the issues that was dealt with in this amendment was trying to deal with some inconsistencies. The issue with respect to local governments on the penalty has been resolved in this amendment, and I believe it at this moment in time is a consensus amendment that we're willing to move forward. Any other concerns are being worked out, but this is a good amendment. We would urge the committee to move forward, adopt this amendment, and get this bill to the floor.
And just for the record, I know the Treasurer's Office has voiced some concerns about tax-free bonds from 2944 and this, and they're continuing their analysis of that.
Correct.
But I feel comfortable moving forward with this today.
And, Mr. Chair, the letter's being distributed right
yeah.
now.
Yeah, that's okay. I was wondering where it was. Thank you. And if you'd like to take a moment to read that, that'd be fine with me. And just, is there anybody else who wants to come up and shed any light on this? Any of the government people? Or, okay. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Holden.
Does the Boley Commissioner have any position on this bill?
Well, they're in the room.
Evidently, they don't.
Chair Choffler, members of the committee, for the record, Mark Zoltan, Legislative Affairs Director, Bureau of Labor and Industries. The Bureau is supportive of the Dash 3 amendments.
Any more questions? All righty, I'll entertain a motion.
No, I'm not finished reading.
All right, I'll sit here and relax and wait. Committee's pleasure is to hold this over. I'd be happy to do that. I'd like to get going. You feel comfortable doing that?
Hold it over? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we're going to do. Close the work session on House Bill 2021. And I am going to open a. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2915.
Mr. Chair, actually, can we be at ease for a second?
Yes, we'll stand at ease. Oh, excuse me. we're back in order. We'll close. I take that back. We'll close the public session hearing on House Bill 29195. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3061. 3061.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3061 requires Public Employees Retirement Board to allow retired members and beneficiaries to make voluntary monthly contributions to labor organizations. And the measure also requires that the cost of administering the measure's provisions are paid from contributions made by members and beneficiaries. There's currently a Ways and Means referral on the measure. However, we have received permission to have it removed.
Very good. Joe Schaefer. Please, come on up here and help us out.
Hello.
Good morning.
I'm Joe Schaefer. I'm with the Service Employees International Union, Local 503. This is a bill that actually was started by the members of our retiree local. They're a fairly new group for us that's only been around for a couple of years, at least in this incantation. They've come and gone, you know, depending on activity level for some time. And their goal was to create a little bit more stability in their organization, and this was an idea that they put forward and asked us to move on. And so that's what I've done.
Very good. Any questions, Mr. Schaefer? Just so we know. Representative Berger.
Are we going to hear further? Is this it?
That's it. Joe's the only Mark.
Okay. So basically, you got a retiree on PERS, and they can have their dues deducted from their retirement pay. Are there other deductions from retirement pay that are authorized in statute?
Not that I know of.
Well, that doesn't mean there aren't.
Yeah,
I think that's a true. Good question, and I'd Steve like Williams, it answered.
Mr. Delaney, why don't you come on up here and shed some light on this issue for us? I mean, the way I read it here, I don't have any problem with this. I just don't understand why they can't already.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Delaney, Deputy Director of PERS. Yes, we actually do have some deductions at the moment dealing with health insurance deductions, where an individual can have their part of their benefit directed directly to the health insurance company, which is covering them.
But that's it?
That is it at the moment.
No United Way, no...
Not from retirees, no. Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, we have had some inquiries from other groups on this. We're looking at it. While we didn't introduce this bill, we've already kind of been, we weren't sure that we necessarily needed legislative directive on the inquiries we received up to this date. This would make it very clear for us. But we've been looking to see what would be involved in trying to make such a deduction and payout from the system.
Further question,
yes, Representative.
Mr. Schaefer, how many folks are going to be asking for this, do you think, Joe?
We've had about 20 of our active members of our retiree local who have been following this pretty closely who would like to participate. We haven't really, like, done any publicizing or asking.
Is there anything that prevents them from going to their bank and getting an automatic, you know, couldn't your local make it online, you know?
Yeah.
Touch of a finger instead of going through the state agency to have it done that way?
Some of them do. Not all of our retirees like online bill payment, and that was actually a discussion in a retirees meeting. Somebody brought up the exact same deal, and they were pretty adamant that they want to act much more like a traditional union, and so this was one of the things that they were really hoping to gain. When it comes to, like, online bill payment and that type of stuff, not all of them were comfortable with that idea.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification.
Representative, please go ahead.
They want to act more like a regular union in the sense that union dues are taken out of their paycheck. Is that the issue here?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand and I'm sympathetic to their need, but I'm not supportive of this because I think it opens the door to a huge number of these kinds of things that, you know, we're gonna have a statute today on deductions from PERS. It is a retirement payout. It is not a paycheck, and I'm not looking favorable on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Schaefer, I'm not going to work this today. I want you to go to the committee and explain yourself a little bit further and try and get as many people to yes as you possibly can.
Oh, yeah, and you know, to be clear, this is not just SEIU. Other labor organizations are supportive of this as well, and they're willing to help with that effort.
I wish they were here.
Yeah. They actually were here on Wednesday. We had
I understand.
Some of those
I understand
there,
completely,
so.
But, yep. You know, they stay at the state, please. It isn't a perfect world. I want to talk to Mr. Delaney and myself. I want to get further explanation why we're doing this.
Okay.
Before we go ahead and do it.
Sure.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close public hearing on 3061. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2998.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2998 modifies the definition of a public works to include the fabrication or manufacture of non-centered items that are produced by a contract specifically for a public works project for which prevailing wage rates are required.
Okay, I'd like to call.
Keith, just by representative. Ken, if you wish.
Is that?
No, I can just from here.
All right, that's good. Okay, what do we got? Tom Goodhive from SMACNA.
Which one are we on?
2998.
Mr. Chair, maybe I'll go down and join.
Yeah, Representative, please do. I would
get you started here.
Just more later, but I want Representative to go first, please. Just stay right where
okay.
You're fine. And Representative, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. State Representative Paul Holby, for the record. District 8. I introduced this bill after coming across an issue that many contractors face in public works contracts, where they're competing against contractors who are basically fabricating and assembling a lot of the products off-site in their yards or some other location and trucking them onto site so they can avoid paying prevailing wage. And it makes it very difficult for contractors to compete against this in a fair, equitable way. I have unfortunately don't have the amendments to this bill here to present to you, but there's amendments in LC at this time trying to clarify the difference between some of the products we're talking about. We really are talking about products that are assembled and fabricated, a practice that is normally done on the site for specific specifications of the project. We're trying to exclude products that are actually manufactured, such as some of the pre-stressed concrete products that you see going up and down the highway, where they actually come from a place that actually manufactures them, or like cabinets, where you have a factory that manufactures the cabinets. We're talking about, and I think you'll hear from the testimony sometimes, for example, a plumbing contractor, instead of assembling the pipes and the fittings together, they will do all of that off-site and bring it onto site. And these are then assembling them specifically for that particular project. So it's specific to that. It's not really a standard item that you buy off the shelf that's manufactured specifically. It's something that's assembled. And there's cases where companies actually build specific forms for concrete or build specific walls and virtually truck in entire segments of the building onto the site. So that's what this bill is intended to do, and I'll leave it to some of the other folks here who have experienced trying to compete against this practice.
Thank you. Sir, go ahead.
Yes, Representative Schaffler, committee. My name is Tom Goodhue. I'm the executive director of the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association, representing sheet metal and air conditioning contractors for the state of Oregon. Along the lines of what Representative Holvey said, there certainly is a trend out there that components that were at one time actually fabricated on site have been trended towards moving off site in order to specifically avoid having to fall under the prevailing wage rules that the state has in place. But even a little bit different twist. My experience prior to moving to the state of Oregon was as a contractor in the state of Washington, where we did have Little Davis Bacon and participated in prevailing wage on all state projects for manufacture and fabrication of all the ductwork that we did. Just one other twist to add to this, and that is that with the technology today, with CAD drawings, electronic communication, it's not unforeseeable for things as specific as what we build. And we build duct that is specific for a building. I think that you guys can all recognize the fact that what was designed for this particular room was custom done based on size, volume of air that had to flow out of it, the equipment that was running, all of that stuff was specifically made and manufactured and installed for purposes just for comfort in this room. And today, you could literally come in and field verify what you needed to do, go online, type it in, punch a button, and have it brought in from Mexico if you wanted to. So just to let you know, I represent about 30 contractors that each one of them has got over $1 million in investment in machinery and tooling to do nothing more than be able to build products to be able to satisfy the needs of the different people trying to develop within the state of Oregon. And you let this thing go too far and you won't have that capacity in this state, and you're going to then allow more competitive situations, lower price, to come in here and really take away some of those jobs.
Any questions?
With that, I'd say I would support the bill, but I do believe, as Representative Holvey has stated, that there needs to be more definition on how to define exactly what would be a non-standard item. I would tell you that most of the products that were employed and are, in fact, non-standard items that we manufacture.
Representative Berger.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I sympathize, and I'll be real interested in the language you came up with, because I think you've described just an overwhelming trend in any kind of manufacturing. There's no such thing as standard anymore. You can go on to a CAD, as you described, and custom build darn near anything and ship it. And it's almost a productivity thing, and I think these are significant changes. I'll be interested to see how you come up with language to describe this, because it is an overwhelming trend, as you imply, and I just am not sure how you can get there, because it's going to be more and more and more. Just a comment.
I've actually visited one of your contractors in the summer. And that was a very sophisticated shop. They had, I'd say, more than $1 million worth of investment there.
Easily.
Yeah, and they were all union workers, too.
If I may comment, Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, I understand your thoughts relative to market-based economy looking for the lowest trend in pricing, and that everything can be basically custom manufactured. But I think that, especially in the construction industry, we're dealing with deliveries and time frames. And unfortunately, the processes involved in procurement usually are the low bid. And I can guarantee you, if somebody gave me a project on a low bid basis, I could shop the world and come up with a cheaper price. But when it comes to actually getting that product there in a timely fashion, because, I gave the example of custom manufactured ductwork. If one thing changes, it could impact a lot of things, and everything has to be rebuilt. If you're waiting for me to get it from Mexico or China, you may be waiting 6 months. And every product on the building could be like ordering travertine marble out of Italy.
Well, exactly, Mr. Chair. And if I could respond, that is exactly why you don't get the second contract. I mean, if you can't produce. My only statement is, it used to be that, you would go in and you'd buy a shirt. Now you can go to places in Europe and buy a shirt out of a vending machine. I mean, we are that good at manufacturing custom to order things, and I just think that you have an interesting dilemma here. And I mean, if you're going to write these laws around ductwork, it's going to look one way. If you're going to write it about preformed any number of things, it's going to look a little different. And I'm just saying that you have a real challenge in writing this statute, because I think that more and more that's the way we are going, is a whole manufacturing sector. That's all. I'm not trying to be obstructionist here. I just think it's a really interesting problem.
Pre-stressed, pre-cast concrete. I don't know if it would be affordable for them to ship it up from Mexico, but maybe it would be.
Well, Mr. Chair, there you go. You used to build a building. Now you bring in blocks of concrete and raise them up.
I'm very familiar with the process, Representative.
Okay. I mean, that's part of the trend.
Any more questions?
Yes, sir. One more comment. I talked about having worked the process in the Seattle area, and I worked for a large mechanical contractor, and, we were a union plumbing and mechanical contracting shop, but as Representative Holvey mentioned, we even assembled in our shop large piping and plumbing situations and then literally took it out to the job site. Now, there were economic reasons for doing that because we could control our costs a little bit better than having to deal with some of the field situations. But obviously, if we were looking to try to avoid paying prevailing wage because it was on the job site and we didn't have to pay prevailing wage because it was in the shop, we could, in fact, take advantage of the situation and basically reduce the cost just in wages alone.
I think with the opening of our borders and the ability to ship things, eventually we'll have the contractors here asking for this, not just the unions. So with that happy note, I'm going to thank you very much. I'm going to call up Amy Joyce and, Brian, I apologize to you, Brian. I didn't see you under Tom's name. Come on up and testify. Excuse me.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler.
All right.
Brian Krieg, I'm here today on behalf of Sheet Metal Workers Local 16. I'd just like to reinforce the things that Mr. Goodhue said on behalf of the contractors. It is a very challenging issue to try to figure out where would you draw a line to demark what is custom and what should be remaining as it has been in the past under prevailing wage on this, and when does it become something that's an off-the-shelf item, such as the air returns. The fixtures that you see here are definitely an off-the-shelf item. It's the stuff behind. And as we know, on many construction sites, as we build them, things do occur where you have to keep a little bit of flexibility, and particularly in ducting and certain piping aspects, you have to be able to customize as the job site evolves. And keeping jobs in Oregon and the capital investment that many of our contractors have made, the investment our unions have made in the training and everything, so that we have the expertise to be flexible and do complex jobs here, helps keep other jobs here. We build fab plants for the chip industry and other high-tech things in this state instead of Mississippi because we have a talented workforce and talented contractors and the base with their manufacturing and assembly plants here to do the job.
I know this much, if they do precast concrete out of Mexico and you haul a several ton double T up here and it don't fit, who's going to be on the hook for that?
And this is dealing with prevailing wage, Representative, and so who's going to be on the hook? Well, is it the taxpayer?
Right. Ms. Joyce, you want to spread some light on this for us?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Joyce from the Department of Transportation. I handed in some written testimony, and I had a couple of points to make, but based on what Representative Holvey was saying, the dash whatever amendments are going to look like, trying to get at things that normally would not be done off-site, and trying to get to those for the prevailing wage. ODOT's concerns had to do with things like precast concrete, the bridge girders, sound walls, a lot of that custom kind of stuff. It sounds like the amendment, the intention here is that we won't be getting to those kinds of things, so I think ODOT's going to be fine with those.
I want you to stay right there, and I want to call John O'Shell and Amanda Rich, some more people that represent government, and then we'll ask questions of the entire panel. I'm sorry I got out of whack here. Amanda, whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here today representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon and the Oregon Association of Water Utilities. I'm here kind of on behalf of the sewer and wastewater and water utilities. They've got pieces of their plants that are made to specification and are entirely made off-site. Things like membrane filtration systems made in Australia. and shipped in canned pump stations for sewers. Apparently, they're these big giant metal cylinders, and you see them driving down the highway. Who knew? But they are not. They are, you know, made to specification. They're not quote unquote an off the shelf item. They are made to meet the individual needs of that utility, and are shipped in. I understand that it is not the intent of this bill to get to those items, and I'm hoping that the amendments that have been mentioned by Representative Holvey will take care of our issues, but would look forward to working on that definition.
Mr. Rochelle.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, John O'Shell, County Road Program Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. Certainly have a problem here. Certainly needs to be dealt with. As you know, Association of Oregon Counties is neutral on the issue of coverage, which means we're neutral on whether it expands or reduces. Our problem comes in when we ask ourselves, how in the world are we going to enforce this thing? And hopefully the lines are going to help. I'd like to talk just a little bit to give you a sense of the kind of problems we're facing. Bear in mind that as an agency, what we have to do is we need to receive the certified payroll from whoever has to pay prevailing wage. So we need to know who to get those from. So somehow we need to make that determination. Right now we make a determination on the prime contract. We've got some time. It's before we ever start advertising. If we have a problem, we go to Boley, we figure it out, and we say, okay, we got coverage. Now we're talking about a bunch of stuff that happens during construction that we're trying to figure out what's in and what's out. Now, when I started asking around, I found out that Washington State has similar provisions, and they've been working on them quite a while, and I've been told that they work quite well. But I got a copy of the document that is what the Washington State Department of Labor and Industries has approved for the Washington State Highway Department. That's one agency. It's 18 pages long. Let me give you a short summary of what they have. First of all, they start with the six sort of overall questions that the Department of Labor and Industries asks, and the first three are pretty clean. The fourth one has this thing, is there any assembly or fabrication? Well, that's pretty vague. Think about just making a culvert. That is fabrication, but I don't think that's what we're after here. I mean, maybe we are. But then the last three questions have words like typically, reasonably, generally, unusual. My guess is that when we try and establish what's in and what's out, there will be differences of opinion. We're going to need some time to work out what's in and what's out. I suspect if we go this way before we're done, we're going to end up with agencies submitting and boldly have to make determinations of what is in and what is out. Getting close to done, but the issue is, you know, they got the cover, and then they got nine pages, includes 62 items they listed. Let me read you number two, frame and grate. Frame and grate for catch basin type 1, 1L, 1P, 2, and concrete inlets. Cast frame, maybe 70-30. I'm a third of the way through, and it will stop. That's how it reads for every item they go through. Then they got three more pages where they talk about, okay, Boley also will have to determine what the prevailing wage is when you're working in the shops. Right now, most of the prevailing wages are designed around when you're out on the construction site, what it is. In Washington State, they determine they need another set of rates for the shop work. So that's additional work has to be done. And then they have two more pages of stuff. They said, well, we had all the rules, but at a later date, we found out things didn't work, and we got to go back and fix it. If we are going to go down this path, we need to set a path as to how these determinations are going to be made, how we're going to get most of these questions answered before we award contracts. Not an easy task, potentially a very worthy task to get done, but if we're going to do this, we need to give the agencies such as Boley and the big agencies that do a lot of construction time to work this out and figure out product by product by product what's in and what's out. Thank you.
Doesn't sound like a very neutral testimony to me, Mr. O'Shell.
It's Chairman.
Anyway, I toured the Bonneville Dam last summer, and they were retrofitting the turbines up there. And they pulled the old propeller, it looks like a giant propeller, out. And those American men and women that built that, the steel workers, had that thing dialed in perfectly, without computers, just machinists in America. They made that so it ran in a perfect circle. Well, they bought the new ones from Brazil. They stuck it in there and it was wobbling. They had to pull it out and send it back. And they were working with computers. We are painting ourselves into a corner here by going, it's like that astronaut said, you know, we're going up to the moon, built on something to the last, the lowest bid. I am sympathetic to this concept, but if people are going to nitpick it like that, I don't know if we can ever get anything done, but I am sympathetic. Any question to this panel?
Just a comment. I know this is a pretty tough subject, but it wasn't the intent to go after products that are manufactured by a particular company that manufactures those products for a business. That wasn't where this was going.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Berger,
I appreciate
are you
that
finished,
com-
Representative Holby?
I am.
I would like to dovetail on that. I appreciate his comment, and that's where I am saying to you, I understand your concept and where you're trying to get here. It's the language that gets to what you want without including all these things, all the what-ifs. And that's why I said this is going to have to be pretty tight language because I can see a zillion what-ifs. That was my point exactly. We agreed.
Thank you very much. Any further question of this panel? All right. Thank you very much. Last but not least, Jessica Adamson, please. Oh, and Sean Miller. Ah, I'm missing a... I wish everyone and Mr. Shipwreck, you're not even on the list, but you're welcome.
I better say something.
Whoever wants to start.
Go ahead.
Age before beauty.
Oh, jeez. It's Friday and I'm thirsty. Bob Shipwreck, Oregon Building.
Hallelujah.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're getting a sample today of some of the problems with the language. I, too, hope to see Representative Holvey's amendments, and I think we're probably still going to have to build on those as well to separate standard, non-standard. I am aware of the Washington law, but I haven't found anyone who says it works really well. So I'd like, once again, develop a bright line standard. It's what I do.
I hate it when you say that.
I knew you guys would like that.
It's like everything else we do in this
like
building, right?
Committee. I am a member of the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee. I brought this up twice at that. It is a group of government folks, contractors, and labor, and we all agreed that this would be an excellent interim project to look at, and we will do that. I will tell you the intent of this is I'm not going to waste my time trying to figure out pipe that's fabricated in China, because we can't even enforce stuff we've got here in Salem. So, but the intent is when you got a contractor that's following the rules versus another guy who's got a bunch of people down the street fabricating this stuff, bringing it on site, and not paying the same wages that the gentleman from SMACNA pays. We have contractors who build brick panels for buildings all over the United States here in Oregon, EFAS systems, all types of things, but they pay it at the prevailed rate, and nobody complains about it. Actually, it's beneficial because the conditions are perfect. My last comment, then I'll leave, because it was kind of just a light story that goes back to what a previous person talked about, and that's low bid when you do this stuff. My brother's a bricklayer and was out on the Madras prison. In fact, just wrapping that job up. I went out and visited him on the job. I had 300-400 people out there and visited with him, and it was kind of funny. I said, what's going on here? All they had was the slabs, and he's got 25 bricklayers out there putting walls up. I said, where's the walls at? And he says, well, the guy that got the low bid, he was going to transport 30-foot precast panels from Spokane to Madras, and guess what? He didn't make the schedule, so everybody's out there with no walls building a prison, and it was, you know, hopelessly set the project back. And as you can imagine, working in Madras in the fall and winter with no even walls or ceilings up, but the job had to go on. But I just thought I'd throw that out as an interesting anecdote of when people are really happy with their low bid. And there's a panel plant just a few miles from the project, but they were second low.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with AGC, and Mr. Shiprock has said it well, the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee, of which AGC is also a member, we have an agreement that it is time to have a conversation about these non-standard items. The industry is changing the way it's doing business, and it's time to look at this and how do we do this thoughtfully, and with my chagrin about a bright line standard, because that's been a lot of fun this session, we do think that developing this thoughtfully, again, trying to get to where Representative Holby is trying to go with this bill, and the idea that there are times when non-standard items are truly manufactured, and the example of Morse Brothers and pre-stressed beams, for example, those are manufactured. It'd be very difficult to call one of those and bring that in under this bill, but there are other times where it would be appropriate to bring those in under prevailing wage, other types of items. And so we look forward to that conversation of working through this important issue as a community that we think we've all bought in, that we need to have that conversation on this issue.
Thank you. Sean, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, here today on behalf of the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors, in opposition to House Bill 2998 as drafted. I appreciate the intent that Representative Holby has indicated, but also recognizing the challenges I think that Representative Berger has kind of illustrated. So I'll just be brief to say that we do have concerns on defining non-standard items as well as what means specifically for that public works project, because I think when you get into manufacture and you're manufacturing items that could go to a public works project or a private works project, there's just a lot of questions. And I do also serve on the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee at the Bureau of Labor and Industries, along with Bob and Jessica, and we have agreed to look at this, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions of this panel? I think EVIS is great for commercial application, but I wouldn't put it on my house to save my life. Just an editorial comment there.
All right.
All right, well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's an excellent conversation. And I think we should pursue something along these lines, Representative. Maybe over the interim, we'll just see what happens. All right, I'm going to close.
Is there anybody else signed up to speak on that? Was that
no. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2998. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3405.
Chair, committee members, House Bill 3405 establishes requirements for information that is included in telephone directories, otherwise known as the section is known as Blue Pages, and directs the Public Utility Commission to establish rules to implement the measures provisions.
Very good. I'd like to call Jim Long and David Olson, please. Hey, God bless you. You're fine, American. More power to you, brother. That's the process. Let me see. Is Solis still here?
Yes.
Oh, there he is right there. Okay. Good. Gentlemen, whenever you're ready.
Why don't you take it first, Dave? Oh, you want me to? Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Schaffler. I mean, committee members, for having a hearing today. I didn't get much sleep last night, so it's the end of the week, and I'm really tired. David, why don't you take over, would you?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you. I'm David Olson. I head cable and utility matters for the City of Portland, and thanks for asking me to testify today. Don't be afeared of this mighty document. I'm going to try to summarize very fast, you know, the key points. But we care a lot about this issue. This bill, House Bill 3405, rightfully establishes the Blue Pages in statute. There isn't that requirement now. And the Blue Pages, of course, are the centralized accessible list of government services, Oregon State services, local government services, schools. The easily accessible way for people to find basic information. And phone books, of course, remain the record, the tool of choice for finding basic information for every telephone customer in the state, as indeed the PUC rules site. So as long as that phone book remains basic information for everyone, it's very important that the blue pages be there. I'm happy to, really honored to sit next to Jim Long. He was the pioneer of the blue pages concept nearly 30 years ago. It spread out from Oregon nationwide. It's something that Oregon, like many other accomplishments, can take pride in. That it was adopted by the rest of the country. It has been a voluntary matter. Blue pages have been a voluntary matter for many, many years. That's all well and good. However, Representative and Ms. Chairman, you all know it's a very competitive environment now in the telephone system, and the extent to which the blue pages will remain on a voluntary basis is very, very much in question. We have experience with that in Portland. I think we're the only city in the state with split directory. And we've already started to see these very critical listings begin to disappear. It's the Portland yellow pages, it's the Portland white pages. The blue pages disappeared from the yellow pages volume with no notice to us or anyone else several years ago. If you want to find blue pages in our yellow pages volume, well, you find them, it's a list of the lawyers in town. It is not what it is here. And in fact, the business listings are duplicated in both volumes. So there's no reason why the community listings shouldn't be. In fact, this, in many commercial establishments, is the only book you can put your hands on. And it's a basic service like 911 is a basic service like other. Folks need to find information to get public service, to get emergency information, to find schools and other things. It is very important that these pages be accessible to every Oregon citizen, every Oregonian. Yes, Portland has issues because we have a split directory, but we really think, particularly given the commercial pressure on these directories, and you can see the commercial pressure, front, back, sides, advertising, every jot of space is being contested, that it's very important that you establish as a common sense requirement that blue pages carry on as they have been for the last 30 years. And currently, as I said, it's not in statute. We cannot rely on those pages being there. We've already lost them from the second volume of the phone books up in our city. It is a basic level of service for everyone, and we'd encourage you to pass this very simple bill, adopt it as a matter of statewide statute, and carry this forward for everyone's benefit. And I conclude by asking you to schedule a work session on this, move this forward, common sense requirement, and I thank all of you for your time.
Any questions? Representative Berger.
Mr. Olson, what you're proposing is a service to the state paid for or put into a document that is not a public document. It is a private document paid for by somebody else. Am I right?
Representative Berger, Mr. Chairman, telephone directories are part of basic telephone service in the state. The telephone companies have a variety of methods to provide for them, but they're part of basic service. The publication is private. The requirement that these be available to every telephone subscriber is a public requirement.
That helps me. That helps me a lot, because there is another answer here, and that's for every public jurisdiction in the state be required to publish and send out their own documents. In other words, the city of Portland, there's nothing to prevent you from saying this is an incredibly important need for the city of Portland. We're going to assemble a directory and send it once a year to every member of our, you know, our state. There's nothing to prevent you from doing that, is there?
Representative, Mr. Chairman, thank you. You're correct. However, these directories, as part of basic telephone service, end up being the resource of choice. Even the phone company meets their public information requirements in statute by this distribution. This consolidates that information in one place where everyone knows where to reach for it. That's been the way it is. I don't dispute your point, Representative. I'm just saying the common parlance.
This has been the
book of choice. And it still is basic telephone service, part of basic telephone service.
It does help me, Mr. Chair.
Representative, yeah.
It does help me to understand that the book itself is mandated, is a statutory mandate, along with the franchise.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, General. Mr. Long, would you like to add anything?
Yes, I definitely would. I've had bills, 2001, 2003, 2005 sessions. after, here's a quote from May of 2003. I took it to a legislative public hearing or legislative hearing over at the Public Utility Commission, and they concurred and they sent a letter to elected officials. Quote, blue bordered pages provide necessary, often life-saving information to our citizens in one identifiable section of telephone directories. We support the concept of this bill and believe it merits your consideration. Well, it didn't get any consideration that year, so I filed a rulemaking petition, and the Public Utility Commission sent the issue over to the Department of Justice. The first response from the head of telecommunications for the PUC was to decline it. And then I said, hold on, we've been here before, because I've gone through a number of people at the Public Utility Commission over the past decades. And they did the inquiry, and they did find that there was an informal opinion that came out in 1988 by the Department of Justice saying that, yes, the state does have the authority to regulate phone books. They sent it to the Department of Justice to update that, all the legal parameters on that, since a number of things have changed in telecommunications law at the federal level. And Assistant Attorney General Mike Weirich came back with a 10-page memo that clearly said that the state has the authority to regulate the phone books. He also encouraged, in a couple of spots, he encouraged me to have legislation.
Are you all right, Mr. Long? I know you've got
some. I had a tough night.
Yeah. It's okay, buddy. Why don't we just all relax? Okay. Any more questions?
I've got more to hear I can read.
Yeah, well, would you just submit that, and we'll make copies for everyone? I think that'd be best at this point, rather than have you agonizing over all this. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to get on the record. Mr. Long came to my office, and we had an interesting conversation about business rates and government paying business rates, and I'd like to get him to repeat some of that for the record.
Mr. Long, if you're up to it.
As I started in 77, basically back then, and things have changed since then, but there are two kinds of service. Residential service, which you have at home, you pay your rate, and you get one listing in the white page, the alphabetical section. If you have a business, say down at the end of the block, you're a barber, you have a restaurant, you pay business rates. It costs 2.5 to 3 times more, and you're supposed to get an alphabetical listing plus a classified listing. Essentially, government is not a residential, doesn't pay residential rates. They pay business rates typically for their service. So it's important for them to get a classified listing. A person who's looking for an agency or for a business, if they don't know the name of the business, they can't find it alphabetically. So that's why we have the classified sections. The government should have some better classifications. They're only getting one listing at this time, and sometimes they aren't getting any listings at all. The last year's phone book in Portland, in Eugene, Salem, in Medford, Corvallis, Ben, media, after 25 years of having government offices and schools together, they took the public schools out of the blue pages section. Willy-nilly, they just made a business decision, took them out. I know that you've gotten some letters. There have been other complaints from people who had really a lot of difficulty finding schools, parents, grandparents who needed to pick up a son or a grandson, and they couldn't find the school because they couldn't even find the number in the book because it wasn't there where it had been for decades. So there have been complaints about this, and this is one example of there not being a rule and why we want to see there be a rule so there's some standardization here that people can rely on this. It's essential for people who really need to contact these public entities to be able to find them.
Thank you.
Not everybody, not all government fits into that same framework, but a lot of them do. But there is the basic need of people, if they don't know the agency or the office that they're looking for, that they need to have some inroad to help them find it.
And just for the record, Mr. Long, and this is for the benefit of Mr. Berger, I was suggesting you submit your written testimony for your well-being, not the well-being of me or this committee, just for the record there.
I appreciate it.
Any further questions of these gentlemen? Thank you very much.
Could I?
Yes, if you have another statement, go right ahead.
It'll be difficult to get out, but there was a rulemaking proceeding that happened, And it was an issue, I think, of the chicken or the egg, which comes first. Do you set the rule and then have legislation, as the Department of Justice encouraged, or do you go for legislation, which I did, which I came back here to do in 2005, but we didn't get it. So a rulemaking was started. It went through the process, and an order came out from the Public Utility Commission that I didn't think really had much depth. It didn't consider a lot of things that were brought up. It missed a number of items that were presented, and so I knew I was going to keep working on this. There's a number of issues. I was going to appeal it. As soon as I read it, I knew I wanted to appeal it. I put together my material. There, just about the time I knew that my deadline was coming up, I called down to the Public Utility Commission, to their e-filing office, and asked, okay, what is my 60 days? And the staff person there, I don't need to give a name, but the staff person there checked with some other people and came back and said, you cannot appeal this. This past fall, I came across at a establishment in Portland, the telecommunications manager for the Public Utility Commission, and he tells me I could have appealed it. So it's just one of the things, and I'll give you my information about the appeal, but it's one of those things where, as a member of the public who's trying to do something, somehow the system didn't work very well for me.
Thank you. Any further discussion or questions in this panel? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Sure.
Hope your weekend goes a little better than last night, Mr. Long.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I'd like to call Lee Beyer, please. Hear from the Utility Commissioner. And I apologize, Mr. Chairman, for keeping you here this long.
It's perfectly fine. You have to stay here. I can, too.
Okay.
He's used to it. Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Lee Beyer. I'm the chairman of the Public Utility Commission. I'm very sympathetic to Mr. Long's concerns along this. He's been working on it a long time, and I really appreciate that. And I think back and when I was first on the commission, the letter that he read, I might have signed. I think I did, or one of those things. The problem that we're dealing with here is that when Mr. Long started this work back in the Carter administration in the late 70s, we had one phone company, or we had a number, but generally one phone company served everywhere. And that's changed a lot, and so you have more now. And the other thing you had was the commissions in every state regulated everything, the whole thing. You just don't have that anymore. The issue in this particular bill and the structure that I think you have to deal with is the telephone companies no longer own the directories. They've sold them off to, except for the small ones, the big four have sold their directory business off to independent publishers. And I think the issue that you have to deal with, and maybe legislative counsel will tell you something different than the Attorney General has told our commission, that's a private matter in terms of publishing. It's just like publishing a novel. The government, under the First Amendment, can't go in and tell them what to write or what to put in the book. I think that's an issue. The other one is, even if you did go farther and you defined it as such, I think, remember that the phone company, when we say the phone company, I think people are thinking of Quest if you live in most of the state, or Verizon if you live in Washington County. They're not the deliverer of all the numbers anymore, and as I spoke in a different Mr. Hovey's, Representative Hovey's committee a little while ago, we now have about 4.5 million phone numbers or lines in the state. Only half of them are landlines, and only a portion of those are actually by the incumbent owner who you're conceptually dealing with here. So I'm kind of fumbling a little bit here, but I think the issue is really we don't have control. And this bill would direct the PUC to come up with a rule to implement this section, but the rule, we wouldn't have any jurisdiction over the publishers. That's not what we do. We only have jurisdiction over the utility itself. So I think conceptually, if you're going to do this, and our assistant attorney general that represents us has said that the only way that you could conceivably get here is you would have to require that anybody providing phone service in the state, as part of providing that, would have to publish a directory as part of that service. I'm not sure you can do that, but you'd have to do that. And then I suppose you can mandate the conditions under which they would do that. So, Mr. Chair, I don't have an answer for you. I'm very sympathetic, and frankly, I've answered a lot of consumer concerns myself directly in the last year, particularly from Portland schools, and that when they moved the schools out of the blue pages to where they thought they were more convenient in the government pages. I'm happy to answer questions. I'm not sure I've helped you much here.
Thank you, Chairman Byron. I will get to the representative, but you know, the more, and I am sympathetic to Mr. Long as well. I've enjoyed the blue pages too. But the longer I spend thinking about this issue and the more information that comes to light, and the fact that we do have, I don't know when 411 information came in, we have that. And my phone has the internet right on it. And I can literally type in a word and not even spell it right, and all the information can be found. And we're going in that direction. And I am sympathetic to Mr. Long and his plight, and I've enjoyed the blue pages. But because of this, our inability to we would go out and mandate a business, an advertising business, to put something in a publication, that's a big hang-up for me. Representative, any questions or comments of Mr. Byer? Representative Escobar.
Yeah, I just want to agree that it is frustrating. I mean, one would think in Jackson County how difficult it is to get the telephone number of the Rogue Valley Council of Governments. Good luck. That's all I can say. Good luck. And so I understand it, but I think the commissioner's dead on. I don't think you're going to, can't win this one.
Any further comments of the chairman? And Mr. Byer, I appreciate you staying
Thank
so
you.
Long.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I would tell you that if you're able to do that on your cell phone, I can't even get the numbers half the time on a full keyboard. So
I surprise people every day, Mr. Byer.
I guess I'm getting old. The phone directory is my source.
Where do you lodge your complaints on your cell phone anyway?
You're out of order, Representative. All right, now we're going to hear from Mr. Wolf. Matt Wolf, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Brant Wolf with the Oregon Telecommunications Association. We represent all the wireline telephone companies operating in the state with a couple of exceptions. I want to be respectful of Mr. Long and his position and his work. However, the association is opposed to the bill as it's written. We are not obviously opposed to including any of the information that the bill seeks to include. And in fact, a lot of the directors that we publish do. They all do, in fact. They're not all blue, and they're not all in the front of the directory, but they're all there. Some of them are pink, some of them are in gray. But as indicated earlier, the smaller companies are really the ones that still own and publish their own directories. Not all of them do that, but several of them do, and that's what this bill would get at. I did have more stuff to say, but I think I'll just end this by referring to the administrative rule hearing that we talked about earlier. That's AR 464. The commission spent over a year investigating this very issue. Staff proposed a rule, and the commission declined to adopt the rule. At the end of the day, the claims put forth by their proponents, they were not substantiated according to the order. And I think that if you will indulge me just one tiny second, I will end my testimony by reading the very last sentence of the order. In the event that the predictions of the interested persons who submitted comments and spoke at the hearing come to pass, and the public is left without a simple, convenient, fast, and inexpensive means to obtain government and human services listings, the Commission will acknowledge that the marketplace has failed and will not hesitate to open an appropriate rulemaking proceeding and act upon the findings listed therein. So with that, we think it's in the right place. The Commission does have the authority. The DOJ has said that. People argue about that, but the Commission has been given the authority, and we believe that's where this should rest.
Any questions, Mr. Wolf? I just have a comment. I think industry in general tends to shoot themselves in the foot sometimes, and I would request that, humbly request that you all work with your publishers and try and get some, you know, make it easier for people
to find these numbers. I don't know how you're going to do that. I'm not in your industry, and I'm not, you know, I can't direct you to do that, but I think that would be a very friendly thing to do.
So, appreciate that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wolf. Any further questions or comments? Thank you. I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 3405. Is there anything for the good of the order today? All right. We'll stand.